We will see you your Joe Biden story and raise you our Charles Koch interview. The first of a two-part chat about business, politics, and the business of politics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 21st of October. It sure sounded like a campaign stump speech, but today Joe Biden pretty much closed the door on his political career. The vice president said, as you have surely heard by now, that he is not going to run for the top job next year. Insert whatever observation you'd care to make about the way the Democratic field is shaping up. We, however, are going to start today with the GOP, or at least the money behind it. You can't say the phrase Republican political fundraising in this country without the conversation at some point turning to Charles Koch. Mr. Koch is the CEO of Koch Industries, a company founded 75 years ago that today, according to Forbes, is worth $115 billion. I had to mention here that the company is privately held, which makes Charles Koch one of the richest people in the world. Over the past 10 years or so, he and his brother David have used that money and influence to change the political landscape in America, or at least try to, in support of Republican political candidates and policies at all levels of government. Mr. Koch is out with a new book detailing his management philosophies, which is how, full disclosure, we came to get this interview. And we will talk about his views on business and the American economy tomorrow on the program. Today, though, the first part of the conversation we had at his office in Wichita, Kansas last Tuesday about politics and money and how he feels about today's Republican Party.
It's worth a note here that you have written not all that long ago, you know, 20, 30 years ago. If this is our only hope, you said this of the GOP, if this is our only hope, we're doomed.
That's right.
And still, believe that?
Yeah, that's why, although our seminar group contributes quite a bit, political.
So these are the seminars you run twice a year for—
Twice a year.
For largely Republican donors.
Yeah, but my personal money, almost all of it goes into research and education, criminal justice reform, opposing poverty-creating regulations, supplementing the public education system so disadvantaged kids can learn the skills and values required for success that I had the benefit because my parents taught me those.
We should be clear here, though, that your personal money is not the same as the money that the Koch brothers, and I'm saying this with air quotes, spend on politics in America today.
Yeah, and that's, see, the overwhelming majority of that is what people who attend our seminars want to give to.
Okay,
so I give some, and it's still a lot of money, but as a percentage of what I give, it's a very small percent.
Fair enough, but why do you spend so much money in politics if you fundamentally don't believe that the mechanism is working? Because I will tell you, and as you know, you are, to those who disagree with you in politics today, you are pretty much Darth Vader.
Oh, yeah. Right? That's why I get all the death threats.
No, I know you do. I know you do, and that's a serious issue. But you have become the symbol of the political right in this country, the secretive political right.
Right, and that's we're trying not to. I mean, and this is one reason I don't like politics.
That's such a remarkable thing to hear you say.
It's so dishonest. I mean, it's spin.
So if you feel that way, and if you're spending— the Koch brothers, writ large, are spending so much money on politics. Reports are $900 million in the 2016
cycle. No, but see, that's totally wrong.
Okay, what's the number?
Okay, here's the— and this is a budget, and it's a projection of what the donors want to give to. Our latest budget is going to be lower because people aren't contributing
as much.
Probably the total budget over the 2 years, I would guess, would be $750, and the amount in politics is $250.
In millions of dollars.
And as I said, a very small portion of that $250 comes from the so-called Koch brothers, because everybody can choose what they want to give to. So it isn't the Koch brothers doing it. It's other people doing it.
You realize that comes across as sort of disingenuous, right?
In what way? It's the truth.
You organize seminars. You fund grassroots organizations.
Yeah.
You have money in politics throughout the system. And for you to sit there and say, I'm sorry, this isn't really us, doesn't ring true and will not ring true when people hear this interview.
Okay. But here's the thing. if this wasn't what people wanted, other people wanted to give to, the money wouldn't come because we're not putting it up. We've improved the capability because we say, okay, if you want to donate to these, we need to help make it more effective.
So what? How do you figure out your return on investment for the money that you and those who think like you invest in politics in America today? Because as you know, the electoral cycle, the past couple of cycles, has not been really kind to Republicans.
Well, that's not true. In the off years, it has.
Sure. But last time there was a race for the White House, Karl Rove is the guy who stood up and said, what are we doing? We're wasting all this money.
Yeah. No, a lot of it is waste, and so we're gonna do much more thorough analysis and learn from this.
How come you guys are so secretive?
How am I secretive? I'm here talking to you.
You are here talking to me, and I appreciate it. And I'll tell you what, you are everywhere lately, right? CBS Sunday Morning. You guys are in Popular Mechanics, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So clearly, there's whoever's doing your PR is doing a great job. But over the past decade, plus or minus, since 2003 and starting the seminars, you have made an art of not letting yourself be known in the public arena. How come?
Well, see, I always believed what the mother whale told the baby whale. She said, son, the time you get harpooned is when you come up to spout off. So I followed that, and I followed it too long. I've been working in this arena for over 50 years. And for the first 40, we didn't get into politics, so we didn't have this. Then in 2003, because of what the Bush administration was doing, we said, gosh, we've got to get involved in politics.
So let's be clear. That's George W. Bush, a Republican president who was doing things you didn't like, growing government and
increasing
all of that.
Destructive regulations, which led to the Great Recession, mm-hmm. Getting us in wars that were counterproductive, and so on. I mean, because in his campaign, he said a lot of things we could agree with, but then the actual practice was so different, and that's what we find with politician after politician.
Can you trust any of them?
Well, yeah, I think there's a few percent.
A few? Some small number?
A few percent. So that's what I say. We've got to narrow our focus.
Can you foresee a day when you will not be involved in policy and politics in this country?
Oh, yeah. I'm an old guy.
Yeah, but here you are still running a $100 billion company and working 9 hours a day and going to the employee cafeteria when you don't have to.
Well, I work more than 9 hours a day. Come on. Don't give me short shrift here. All right, Come on. What do you think? I'm a slacker?
Well, so that's the question. Here you are almost 80 years old. You don't have to do this anymore.
No, of course not. But I feel a moral obligation to use whatever abilities I have to try to make things better, both in our company and in society. You don't have to agree with me. And it doesn't matter to me, because what counts to me is that I'm doing the best I can by my own standards. If I weren't doing the things I'm doing and I see what's going on, I would be so frustrated I'd probably explode or have a heart attack. But since I'm doing everything I know how, and is it all good? Does it all work? No, as you pointed out, there are a lot of problems with it, but when I'm on my deathbed, that's what I want to be able to say. I screwed up a lot, but I did the best I could, and that's all I can ask of myself.
The idea that you're okay with people disagreeing with you, which hopefully we all are, do you think it's possible for us to have an honest discourse when you have the means to so heavily influence the debate?
I don't see. I would like to more heavily, absolutely. You look at the Republican debate. Do you see the things I've been talking about in the debate? You see people saying these things that I'm saying?
No, sir, I don't.
So how am I influencing the debate? I mean, when we've talked to the politicians.
So you're wasting your money.
Yeah. Well, we haven't put any money into
All right, fine.
So, I mean, we've learned that we need to see who has some chance of trying to make a difference rather than just going with the flow and going right down the stream over the cliff.
I am pretty sure he'd be all right with me saying this. Charles Koch is a feisty old son of a gun. He enjoys a good discussion. Tomorrow on the show, the second part of our conversation about his book, Good Profit, it's called, and what he thinks about the place of business and government in the American economy today. On Wall Street this Wednesday, where just as a reminder, you cannot buy a share of Koch Industries. Not so good, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've come once again to that point where we are obliged to ask whether Yahoo is ever going to get it together. Its latest quarterly profit report delivered yesterday after the bell was a discouraging medley of revenues and profits that fell short of expectations. The company says it is also losing piles of money on expensive content like Community, the canceled NBC show that it picked up, and to rub salt in the wound, in the latest acknowledgement that its search and ad targeting businesses are not first class, CEO Marissa Meyer says that Yahoo is going to make a deal with Google to do those things for them. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison has this from New York Now on the never-ending efforts to turn Yahoo around.
CEO of a big tech company can be a pretty sweet gig. You're insanely rich, and even if things go badly, people still tell you how brilliant they think you are. But at least four times a year, you have to put on a brave face and be honest about the bad news.
Looking ahead, our Q4 outlook, which Ken will return to later, is not indicative of the performance we want.
Yahoo CEO Marissa Meyer has had to deliver news like that following a lot of quarterly earnings reports. She's been at the top for more than 3 years, long enough for some investors to call for her head. But Yahoo's problems may be bigger than any leader can fix.
The outlook for Yahoo is quite bleak. I mean, it's looked like a sinking ship for quite some time.
Kartik Osanagar is a Wharton School professor who follows the digital economy.
I'm personally not sure Yahoo has many CEO changes left. They've been through a series of CEO changes. Marissa Meyer is as big a name as one can get.
Many of the company's troubles predate her. Rick Sommer tracks Yahoo for Morningstar.
Years ago, obviously, Yahoo made a decision to not invest as heavily in technology, and they considered themselves a media company. And this has really plagued the company for the last decade.
Yahoo fell behind as other technology companies raced ahead, such as Google, which now dominates search and digital ads. A big chunk of Yahoo's value now is at stake in the giant Chinese e-commerce company Alibaba, worth about $27 billion. Once that's spun off, that's one less piece of good news Meyer can deliver every quarter. And then the pressure for a turnaround gets tougher. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of things we all probably knew but didn't really want to deal with, researchers at Berkeley and Stanford say adapting to global warming is going to be much more difficult than we had thought. Their new report published today in the journal Nature says there is a temperature sweet spot for productivity. As global temperatures rise, they say poor countries in already hot places could get much poorer, and those countries now in the sweet spot could see economic productivity fall, their wealth with it, as their climates heat up, thus making them less able to spend on adapting to climate change. Marketplace's Andy Baxter unpacks the whole thing.
The researchers looked at the relationship between temperature and economic productivity over the last 50 years. Marshall Burke, one of the report's authors, says they found that an average annual temperature of about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, or 13 degrees Celsius, was a really important threshold.
That is the temperature at which humans are just really good at producing things around the world.
If a country's average annual temperature is below that threshold, Burke says it might actually see an economic boost from global warming. But if it's higher, as is the case in tropical regions, the research projects global warming will hurt productivity. Burke says even countries like the U.S. and China, which are right on the threshold for the ideal average annual temp, stand to suffer.
We project that these countries could be harmed, and often harmed pretty dramatically by future increases in warming.
Burke and his co-authors predict that by the end of this century, these effects will make the world 23% poorer than if not for global warming. And they find no strong evidence that technological advances will shield countries.
Personally, I'd be skeptical.
That's environmental expert Dale Jamieson of New York University. He and other experts say that as societies become richer and more sophisticated, they are better able to adapt to extreme climate events.
Precisely because they're more technologically developed and they have a kind of economic cushion.
Jameson doesn't think the new paper effectively proves otherwise. And as for the idea that there's an ideal average temperature for economic production,
that's a view that's not widely shared.
But Jameson thinks the new research does help show that the toll of climate change will be bad. Just how bad, he says, is still a question. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up, this is really not a way to run a business. It's not a way to govern. When agencies can't plan, they can't hire, they can't adapt to the changing circumstances.
Ladies and gentlemen, the government of the United States. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 48 points today, about 0.2%, 17,168 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ declined 40 points, about 0.8%. 48.40. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points, 0.5%, ended at 2018. Valeant Pharmaceuticals dropped 19% today after a report accused it of being a, quote, pharmaceutical Enron, end of quote. If you remember Enron, you know that is not a good thing. Federal investigators are also looking into Valeant's drug pricing policies. The healthcare sector overall down across the board. Endo International gave back 13%. Allergan dipped about 1 2/3%. We told you earlier about Yahoo's revenue and shortage of expectations there. The company announced a new search advertising deal with Google. We told you about Yahoo slipped 5 2/10%. Alphabet, the parent company of Google, which I think I'm going to stop saying. I think I'm just going to say Google from now on, was down 1 2/10%. General Motors beat expectations with better than expected sales in this country. The stock added nearly 6%. Sticking with cars here, Ferrari was, wait for it, yes, in the right gear for its IPO. The stock revved up 5 3/4%. I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. When an economy changes as fast as China's has, it can be tricky for businesses to keep up. Exhibit A is Yum Brands. When the parent company of Pizza Hut and Kentucky Fried Chicken first went to China back in 1987, there was almost no competition. And at one point, it was making more money over there than it was back home. Now Yum has spun off its China division into a separate company, and one reason, explains our China correspondent Rob Schmitz, is the changing tastes of the Chinese consumer.
It wasn't long ago in China when you'd impress a date with a romantic evening at Pizza Hut. Not anymore. China's got a new middle class, says Sean Ryan, author of The End of Cheap China.
And they're really trading up. They're looking for more premium, healthier food destinations. So companies like Starbucks and Pizza Express are absolutely booming in the country.
That last one, Pizza Express, was British until it was bought by a Chinese equity firm last year. Dozens of boutique Chinese brands have crowded the market, appealing to younger Chinese who are looking for a more personalized dining experience. That's why, says JWT's Asia Director Tom Doctoroff, Starbucks has dethroned KFC as the next big thing in China.
It's all about matching the flavor to your own personality. I mean, this is something that kills two birds with one stone. One, it has the scale of a famous brand, but also it has something that's very personalized to reflect who you are.
But that doesn't mean Yum Brands, nearly 7,000 KFCs and Pizza Huts in China, are suddenly empty. EPCO's Jim McGregor says there will be plenty of consumers for years to come.
Who are those consumers? Those are the migrant workers who are moving into the cities at a rate of about 13 to 15 million a year. And they've got to make them consumers in order to drive this economy.
And as long as China's economy keeps growing, those new consumers will be looking to KFC and Pizza Hut for their first date nights. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We're a couple, 3 weeks away from the next fiscal crisis facing us, whether or not to lift the debt limit. Congress and the president will go round and round about that, and we will be here to tell you about it. And then in early December, there is going to be another one. The current continuing resolution, that's budget speak for short-term funding mechanism, expires on December 11th. The thing is, continuing resolutions are supposed to be the exception, not the rule that they have become. And that
is no way to run a railroad, if I can mix my metaphors here. Darren Samuelson at Politico spent some time looking into what happens when you, and by that I mean we, lurch from budget crisis to budget crisis. Darren, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We have, it seems, become accustomed to budgeting the government of the United States this way, haven't we?
It's amazing, debilitating, unprecedented. You might want to wonder, is that really true? But actually, no. We have just been continuing resolution after continuing resolution. Every year it happens. Everyone pats themselves on the back that the government hasn't shut down.
Yeah.
But in reality, it is a an epic crisis that's really just right underneath the surface that people don't necessarily see.
There are real philosophical differences in Washington about how to spend the government's money. So you would look at this and say, well, if you want the government not to spend money, this makes some sense. Just, you know, don't do a budget and let them go with what they had the year before.
It seems like it could make sense. I mean, there was really only a very few people who would say that they have no problem with the continuing resolution. Chuck Grassley, the Iowa Republican, said to me that he was, as long as the government's not shut down, he's fine with it. But this is really not a way to run a business. It's not a way to govern. When agencies can't plan, they can't hire, they can't adapt to the changing circumstances. When a continuing resolution is put into law, basically, you can't really plan for the things that, you know, might pop up that are different from year to year, from Ebola to people jumping over the fence of the White House, to Iraq, Afghanistan, the changing circumstances there. The Pentagon obviously is the most affected by a continuing resolution, and it's been living under one here for many years in a way that it never had to before.
Just to be clear, if I run the local Fish and Wildlife Office in Missoula, Montana, and I've got an opening and we're under a CR, I cannot go out and hire that person.
That's correct. I mean, there is a restriction on hiring new people that kicks in on October 1. And I think a lot of agencies wait until they get funding, until they have instructions that they're allowed to do that going forward.
And by the same token, if I'm the Secretary of the Navy, I cannot order myself up a new aircraft carrier.
You cannot order up a new one. It makes long-term contracts, which is really how the Navy and the Army operate, that much more miserable too, because, I mean, they're trying to buy in bulk, use the government's purchasing power. But they'll pull back on these long-term contracts. They'll do short-term contracts for a couple of months rather than do a full long year, two, three, four-year contract in order to fit within the confines of what they're legally allowed to do.
Just because it's been a while, how is this supposed to work, this whole budgeting process?
Well, it's supposed to work in a pretty wonky but sort of way that dates back to the Nixon administration. But the president submits a budget. Congress writes its own budget. It tells the appropriations committees, through their power of the purse that they have in the Constitution, to write individual spending bills that handle each of these agencies. That should all be done by September 30th as we start the fiscal year on October 1. But it hasn't happened since fiscal year 1997, back when Bill Clinton was about to be reelected. Has it happened where every single agency has been funded on time?
I was going to say that this is a stupid way to run a government, which it is, right? I mean, but that's not where I'm going with this question. Do the people in Washington who are doing this know that it's stupid? I mean, if we think it's stupid on the outside, they must know it's just bananas.
Yes, absolutely. They know it's bananas. Everyone up there on Capitol Hill, with a few exceptions, thinks it's crazy too. But the blame goes both ways. They start to break down immediately as soon as the president issues his budget request. And we are sort of mired in this budget gridlock that really probably will not see any new oxygen in the room until a new administration comes in. So it's kind of sad to say, but I think that's where we're headed.
Darren Samuelson writes for Politico. His piece that we've been talking about is called Welcome to CR Hell. Darren, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which Subway's foot-long sandwiches are actually going to have to be a foot long. I'm not sure how I missed this earlier this week, but the company has settled a lawsuit prompted by pictures that went viral showing a foot-long sub coming in at 11 inches. The whole thing turned into a class-action lawsuit, hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, all for an inch of, really, honestly, kind of mediocre sandwich. All right, before we go, don't forget part two of Charles Koch tomorrow about his thoughts on business and the economy. It's a good one, promise. All right, the Dow off 48 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 40 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points. That is 0.5%. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.